Today's Tesho will be on Case 19 in the Book of Serenity. Case 19 is entitled Yunmen's Sumeru. Introduction. I always admire the novel strategies of Yunmen. All his life he pulled out nails and wedges for people. Why did he sometimes open the door and set out a bowl of glue or dig a pitfall in the middle of the road? Try to discern. A monk asked Yunmen, when not producing a single thought, is there any fault or not? Yunmen said, Mount Sumeru. Verse, not producing a single thought, Mount Sumeru. Yunmen's gift of teaching is not stingy in intent. If you come with acceptance, he imparts with both hands. If you go on doubting, it's so high you can't get a hold. The blue ocean is wide. The white clouds are peaceful. Don't put so much as a tip of a hair in there. A phony cockcrow can hardly fool me. I still won't agree to let you pass through the gate in the confusion. So this is the first day of our August 2012 session, and everybody did a really excellent job this morning. We got up early and we came into the Zendo at 5 o'clock, listening to the sounds of late summer, and we recited the sutras. We had tea, and then we sat. And then the sun came up, and we had breakfast. We cleaned up the Zendo, and more sitting. One way to think about Zazen, sitting, is that it's this very strange practice. You know, you have to have a zafu and a zaptan, and you sit with your legs on the mat or tucked under you, and you breathe through your dantian, through your hara. You squeeze the breath in and out, and you know, you may have a little pain, you may be tired, and you wait for the bell to ring. And it's almost like a contest, you know, trying to get through that 30-minute period until the bell rings. And, you know, when I first started doing Zazen, I wasn't really sure what I was doing. You know, I had a hard time getting through those sits. But every once in a while, I would get up from a sit, and I would hear like the sound of the crickets chirping, or the cicadas, the katydids, and it was just the sound in my mind was like dropping a pebble into a cave, and hearing no return, no reverberation. And you think, wow. You know. Or like looking into a dark room and there's just nothing in there. I don't know if I'm making any sense, but you know, I didn't really know why I got into Zazen. But I would go to sit at the university. We used to have sitting at the university. And I would sit, and I would struggle with this posture. You know, I would sit down, and I was trying to learn how to sit half lotus. And after 25 minutes, I would be covered with sweat. And I would think, I'm not sure what I'm doing. I don't know what I'm doing. But then, all of a sudden, I would realize that my, maybe not always consciously, but sometimes consciously, I would feel this state of absorption or stability. This state of almost like motionlessness inside myself, deep stillness. Somehow I would grow calm and at ease. And so I would go back to the cushion again and sweat it out. Sometimes I don't think I consciously noticed that my mind was changing, but I just felt better. You know, when I would do Zazen, I would feel different, would feel better. When I started doing this, I was a graduate student at the University of Washington. And I was not really that well prepared for graduate school. This morning, while I was sitting, I remembered that my first grade in graduate school was a B+. I took a course with a professor named John Coldaway, and it was on medieval theater. And I don't know why on earth I took that course, because it was amazingly boring. And I tried so hard to be a good student. And I wrote my paper, and I knew my paper was boring, and the teacher gave me a B+. Well, in graduate school, in English anyway, a B+ is like an F. It means we don't necessarily want you to be in the graduate program, but we don't want to embarrass you. So usually students who got a bunch of B+s in our department would not go beyond the master's degree. So I got a B+ in his course, I got an A in another course, fortunately. But I was very tense, and I would go to these classes, and I felt that I was competing with people who were much more capable than I was. And I would be a little bit stressed all the time, and I would go to do Zazen at the university, and I would sit for 25 minutes in a sweat, trying to maintain this crazy posture. And then I would get off the cushion, and I just felt better. And at some point, it might have taken years, I got off the cushion and I looked at my own mind. I looked back at my mind and noticed that it was really empty and dark and still. And this feeling this state of awareness, this empty, dark, still mind, was really profoundly comforting to me. You know, it was really profoundly comforting to me. I didn't know what it was, and I didn't really think that much about it, but I noticed it every once in a while. I would notice that my mind was in this state, and then my mind would go back to its usual busy, chattering state. But sometimes on the cushion, I would enter this deep, blank state. It was as though everything around me was moving. But when I would go deep into myself, so to speak, there was this stillness, this firmness. You might know the name, there was a great Indian, American Indian leader named Sitting Bull. I love that name, Sitting Bull. You know, a bull is a big animal, right? Very big, very powerful. And a sitting bull, that's really stable, you know, that's really calm. he must have been quite a person to have such a name. Or perhaps his father was very wise and knew that it would be a good thing to be a sitting bull. But you know, when I would do zazen, sit down on the cushion, it was hard to be a sitting bull. You know, I wanted to squirm, I was uncomfortable, I was nervous, very nervous. There was this background of anxiety all the time. I realize now I probably had an anxiety disorder, as they say. It was hard to get released from that, you know. Even when I was having a drink with my friends or going to the movies, even a sex, you know, there's always this undercurrent, or in the back somewhere there's this anxiety. I could never quite escape from it. But when I would do zazen, I would be free. It was like somehow at the core of myself there was this stillness, imperturbable stillness. And I didn't know what it was. But when I would sit, I would feel better. And so even though sitting was very, very hard for me, you know, I continued to practice Zen because it would take me to this place. You know, this place where my mind would be still and dark and very calm. And it would take a lot of work to get there sometimes, you know. I would sit on the cushion and chatter away mentally, think. It took me a while to sort of stumble into this state, or stumble into the discovery of this state, you know. When I started doing zazen, I realized now that I was thinking a lot on the cushion all the time, mostly dreaming. You know, mostly just dreaming. I would sit down on the cushion and I would start reliving things from my past, or I would start thinking. And long stretches of thinking would go on the cushion. Sometimes I would rehearse events that had happened in my mind, or I would actually have like fantasy conversations. You know, like telling myself a little story. Sometimes I would remember things from books, you know. And I would go in to see my teacher, and I was trying so hard in Dokusan to impress him and to show him that I was a very smart person and worthy of his respect. You know, I would go in and sometimes I would quote poetry or something like that. I would talk about literature I'd read, and my teacher would just immediately shut me down. He'd just ring the bell at the end of the Dokusan, and sometimes he would say, you know, this is not Zen. It's not Zen. I thought, not Zen? Well, what have I been doing? I've been sitting on the cushion, you know, for hours, you know, not Zen. I don't know when it was that I discovered that my mind was very blank. Could be, or at the center of my mind, there was this blankness. You know, even before, I think it was even before I started sitting with Genki Roshi, I did try to do Zazen on my own. And one time, I had to take care of my father's house. My wife and I were staying in my father's house in Northern Virginia. I hadn't gone back to Seattle yet, and I was meditating on my own. And the house was very cold. My father didn't want us to turn the heat up. So we had sweaters all the time. We would just live in the kitchen. There was a space heater in the kitchen, and I remember one night meditating out in the dining room, and my mind just became totally blank and dark. And I thought, gee, what's that all about? That was interesting. And then, you know, I about a year later, I was sitting with Genki Roshi, and never connected Zazen again with that event. You know, only later did I realize that something had happened, something special had happened when I was meditating and fell into that blankness. You know, sooner or later, if you keep sitting, you will get to that place. It may just be for a split second. It may be for longer periods, but every once in a while, you'll get up. Usually, sometimes you notice it most when you get off the cushion and you walk outside and you suddenly realize you're not thinking. And if you look at your mind, you'll notice it's quite blank, quite empty and dark. And that you may have this experience when you're in that state of feeling rather calm or at ease, yeah? This is really very important. Now, you know, every once in a while somebody comes in to see me in Dokusan and they can actually get angry. You know, they'll say things like, you know, I just never have that experience. You know, when I sit on the cushion, all I do is talk, talk, talk. And the person will be frustrated and you know, angry almost. They'll say, you always talk about these strange states, but I never have them. I just sit on the cushion and talk, you know, think. And, you know, that's complicated. It's very complicated, you know, why people have such a hard time getting to this place. It's not a personal defect. I think it has to do with lack of trust. Lack of trust. When we're growing up, if we have a decent life, a decent enough life, we have these experiences of trust that are supported by the world, you know. So, basically, when you're a little kid, you know, you might have gone out to play, and you might have walked through the grass and, you know, felt the wind in your face and so on, and that's good, right? World is a good place to be. When you were sick, maybe your mother used to take care of you. When you were crying, maybe your parents used to comfort you. When you, you know, were hungry, somebody fed you, and so on and so on. And, you know, you don't remember all of these events, but there's a kind of a deep, unconscious trust, trusting mind that develops. You don't remember all the times when the world responded to you with loving kindness and care. But this is like the foundation of our awareness. This trusting mind. Trusting mind. And it's really like the deepest level of our consciousness. As we're, you know, it is always there. As a kind of unconscious foundation for everything else, this trusting mind, this mind of harmonious connectedness. A million times, the world has responded to you with loving kindness. When you were cold, you became warm. You know, when you were hungry, you ate. When you opened your eyes, a beautiful sunlight, you know, sparkling on the floor. You know, this feeling of trust in the world, trusting the world, is a kind of unconscious foundation of the mind. As we're growing up, however, you know, things happen to us that undermine our trust. They just do. You know, it would be nice not to have that happen, but it pretty much happens to everybody, you know. We have accidents, you know, you get a new bicycle and you have an accident on your bike. And next time you get on your bike, it's a little harder. You know, maybe, you know, some people, it didn't happen to me, but I knew people who, you know, had like a teenage love affair, you know. And really, really gave themselves to this relationship. And then it, you know, would very hurt. You try to do something and you just don't succeed. You know, that can be so difficult. I was reading in the paper about the Olympians. Do you know that a lot of Olympic competitors come home from the Olympics and suffer from depression? Isn't that interesting? Even the people who win medals. I thought that was just fascinating. They have very high rates of psychological maladaption. Maybe you might expect that, right? They dedicate themselves single-mindedly to this event. And then when it's over, they sort of say, well, who am I now? You know, what am I now? You might have watched some of the Olympics. You know, you see all those competitors on the track, and only three of them get a medal, and the rest are really nobody. You know. So you know, let's say you've trained all your life, and you have given your everything to something. You know, you get up every morning just like what we did. And you go out to the track and you run every day and you time yourself and you limit your diet and you don't go and play on Saturday, but you practice at the gym. You've done that since you were a little boy, a little girl. You run in the Olympics and then you don't get a bronze medal, you don't get a silver. You know, that undermines your trust, because in our minds, you know, the story is, I got up every day, I trained, I went to the track, and then at the Olympics, I won. You know, that's the story. And it undermines trust. You know, a friend of mine, I know a woman whose brother became a doctor, and she admired her brother greatly, and she wanted to be a doctor. And it was her fortune or misfortune to be a sister of somebody who had an incredible mind. I mean, really an incredible, retentive mind. And who sailed through all his science courses and all his medical school courses. And then the sister wanted to follow, and she couldn't follow. She just wasn't good in the sciences. She didn't have that kind of ability. That's very difficult, right? That undermines trust. You know, so things happen that undermine trust. You know, you get married, you say, I love this person, I'm going to live my life with this person, and this is the person you chose out of all the people in the world to share your life with. You know, and then, you know, 5 years later, you can't have a civil word between one another. You're arguing all the time. You know, the person looks at you with a look of hate. And that really undermines your trust, right? Or maybe the person betrays you, you know. Person, you come home and the person has fallen in love with somebody else. You know, these things happen to people all the time, and they undermine our trust. You know, and some things had happened to me, I suppose, growing up, that really undermined my trust. By the time I was, 22 years old, I was really in a relationship with the world that was very distrusting. And so when I would go in to see Genki Roshi, I would just talk and talk and talk. And I would tell him all about poems that I had read and ideas, and he would say, this is not Zen, this is not Zen. And I would get back on the cushion and I would talk and talk and talk and talk. Why was I talking so much? You know, I was the only person listening. I was talking so much because I was trying to distract myself from something that made me afraid, you know, made me not trust. So we all develop these habits of mind which are based upon evading our distrust of the world, you know, hiding it, concealing it from ourselves. And we develop elaborate strategies that can be very self-destructive, you know, getting drunk a lot, becoming a doper, you name it. You know, there's lots of things. Having a lot of, there's nothing wrong with sexuality, but just having a lot of unloving sexuality, you know. You know, basically, it's like distracting ourselves from something, but what, you know? And then, you know, you come to Sesshin maybe when you're 22, if you were me, and you talk. And you are trying to avoid something, right? You know, when we sit down on the cushion, you know, we may find the thing we don't want to confront. We may find something, you know, something that's really hurt us that we didn't want to look at, you know? And it may take years to look at it. In the stories in Zen literature, you know, there are stories about Zen students who just go for years and years before their minds become calm and blank. Or before they become aware that their minds are calm and blank. There was a story about a monk whose name was Diamond Shu. And Diamond Shu was a great scholar of the Diamond Sutra. He would recite lectures on the Diamond Sutra. And everybody would say, Diamond Shu is a brilliant man. He knows all about Buddhism. And one day, Diamond Shu heard somebody talking about Zen. And Diamond Shu said, what is Zen all about? And a person said, well, Zen says you don't have to read any sutras at all. You just have to practice Zazen and look at your own mind. And of course, Diamond Shu, who had spent his life studying the sutras, became furious. He was furious. And he said, these people are heretics. You know, I'm going to expose them for the frauds they are. Where are they located? And anyway, he went to this major Zen temple and met the teacher, whose name was Tokusan. And, Diamond Shu eventually became a student of Zen, but for years and years and years, the story relates that he would go into Dokusan and just talk and talk and talk and talk and talk and talk. Afraid, so afraid of something, right? Something. Just, if I keep talking, I won't have to notice this, right? This is such a habit. So anyway, one day Diamond Shu was talking. And it had become night. Apparently this was like the endless Dokusan. So he went into Dokusan and just, his teacher was so nice, he just let him ramble on for like an hour. It had become dark, and the teacher says, uh-oh, it's dark outside, you're going to need a candle. And he handed it to Diamond Shu, and then Diamond Shu took the candle and the teacher blew it out. And then, Diamond Shu suddenly looked and realized his mind was blank. His mind was blank. Under all that talk, under all those distractions, there was this blank mind. We're a lot like Diamond Shu. You know, it takes a while sometimes to encounter that blank mind. When we do encounter it, even just for a split second, generally speaking, we become more calm. It's like encountering that trusting mind. The first time you experience that blank mind, you might not think much of it. You know, you just think, that's interesting, my mind's a little blank. Or you feel very calm, very centered and stable. You might think that's the end of it. That's what Zen is all about. But actually, that's the beginning of Zen practice, is encountering that blankness, which we call mu in Zen. And as I said last night, that blankness is like the tip of an iceberg. I mean, that blankness is, conscious mind is like the tip of an iceberg. A conscious thinking mind, the talking mind, is like the tip of an iceberg. You know, we live on the tip of an iceberg. We live on the surface of something which is much deeper than that. You know, under that chattering mind, under that fearful, nervous mind, which is like whistling past the graveyard, right? There's this deeper mind, which is like Mount Sumeru, you know. So when we're sitting on the cushion and we're talking in our minds, nervously rehearsing our routines, you know, at some point it stops, and there's this experience of blankness. And at first that blankness doesn't feel like much, but eventually if you return there and return there, you realize that it's very, 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 very deep and vast. It's not the way we normally think about the mind. You know, when we say mind, we normally think about our conscious minds. And we aren't really aware of this vast unconscious mind, which is always under the surface. But what makes Sesshin so special is that we have the opportunity at Sesshin to really encounter it deeply. You know, you all came to Sesshin and you had to make arrangements in your schedules. And I'm so glad that you did, because the difference between ordinary daily sitting and Sesshin is the difference between sitting in a bathtub and swimming in the ocean. Yeah. So ordinary practice is necessary, right? You know, you get in the bathtub, you cleanse your mind a little bit, you wash away the dirt of the day, and you towel off and you go on to your job, you go out to your party, whatever you want to do. And that's wonderful, very important. So please keep bathing in the bathtub. But when you come to Sesshin, you have the chance to encounter the Mount Sumeru. You have the chance to encounter that mountain which is under the surface of your conscious mind. Very big, very vast, timeless, ageless. This is what we're really doing when we come to Sesshin, right? You know, we live in a very small world, which is complicated, you know, and feels, I guess, in its own way, very vast, you know. So, the world of microbiology is infinite in a certain way, right? You know, there's always more to research. The world of engineering and environmental engineering, infinite. The world of historians, infinite, you know, in a certain way. But there's another kind of intelligence which comes from that place, which is absolutely trusting. Absolutely trusting. And that is the Mushin. That's the Mount Sumeru. And so normally our relationships with the world aren't profoundly trusting. You know, they're just not. Even though we live on trust, you know, even though we can't live without trust, trust is hard to achieve, or hard to come by. I walked into the bathroom today, and as we were walking into the bathroom, there was a cricket sitting on the edge of the sink. I don't know if you noticed, but it was a little cricket on the edge of the sink. And the minute I saw that little cricket, because I've been doing Zazen all morning, my heart was filled with love, right? I just felt, I wanted to just kiss that little cricket. You know, it's such a beautiful creature. And the whole universe is a cricket if you're in a Mushin mind. And you see this little innocent animal. I mean, maybe he's not innocent. Maybe he eats other crickets. I don't know. But he seemed innocent to me at that time. And he's sitting there on the edge of the sink. And he's so beautiful and so fragile and so small in such a huge world. You know? And I thought to myself, normally I would have worried about him. I would have thought, I hope he's going to be okay. Maybe I'll try to put him out the window. But I knew that, you know, these are people who have come to do sesshin, so nobody's going to walk up and squash him. Or wash him down the drain. And maybe other people would come and see the little cricket and say, oh, I really love this little cricket. I love this cricket. The whole universe is a cricket. And so I thought, this is a good chance for... I enjoyed my encounter with the cricket. And I thought other people would too. And, you know, basically, the thing that moved me about that cricket was his smallness in such a vast world. You know, one swipe of our hand would end his life. You know, just somebody could just come in, look at him, and end it for him. You know, a mistake would end his life, right? This morning, when I got up and I came into the Zendo, I was coming in. It was such a beautiful morning, cool, beautiful. And right as I entered the portico at the edge of this building, I looked up and there was a giant spider. Giant. And I blew on him, and he, of course, started climbing right back up, you know. He was almost at my eye level, and I just went, whoosh, and he starts going right back up. He was like, be safe, little spider. You know, please be safe, you know. This little creature on a thread, you know, not even a millimeter thick, in the wind and the rain, you know, his life is so fragile. Again, you know, you could step on him by accident, right? And we want to, you know, we would like to believe we're not like the cricket, we're not like the spider, but we are, you know, we are. The other day I was looking at a picture, I think it was by the great Japanese artist Hiroshige. Maybe I'm getting the artist wrong, but it was a picture of Japanese fishermen. And it was such a profound picture because it showed this mighty ocean, very tumultuous. And it was a storm-tossed sea, as we would say. There was a little bit of a shore, and the shore, the cliff at the edge of the sea, was very precarious itself. You know, it was like the cliff could crumble, the sea is tumultuous. And this fisherman is on the edge of the water. I think he had a net, trying to pull either a net or a line. And you just realize these humans are very small, very vulnerable, very tiny in this vast world, this vast universe. And we want to believe, you know, I'm not a cricket. There's a famous American poet who said, I am the master of my fate. You know, I'm the captain of my ship. It's like, you've got to be kidding. Right? That is somebody who's talking to himself all the time to avoid facing the truth, right? You know, that person is lying out of his teeth. Humans are very precarious, very small. The universe is a big place. All kinds of unexpected things happen. We control very little. And we have a hard time admitting that sometimes because it's so terrifying. Right? It's frightening. But that's the truth. You know, there's a lot we can't control. You know, it just happens. Things just happen, right? We may not want to face that, but we know it. You know, it's like an undercurrent, and so there's this anxiety all the time, right? You know, you want to win at the Olympics. You train every day. You train as hard as you possibly can. You go to the Olympics and you don't get a silver medal. You don't get a gold. You don't get a bronze. And you go home. That happens to most people who compete for the Olympics, right? And so, you know, basically, how do we live in this world which is uncontrollable, unpredictable, in which, in fact, we are quite tiny and vulnerable? And we all have to live on trust. Trust. And so, you know, basically, the good news is that we develop all of these dysfunctional habits of evading life and not facing the precariousness of things. But at the center of our consciousness is this trusting mind, this infinitely trusting mind, this great emptiness, you know, this Mount Sumeru. When we are in the small mind, you know, nervous, fearful, anxious, grasping, you know, it's hard to hear the sound of the wind. It's hard. You know, we try to get something out of the experience that will ratify our specialness. We can try to have a mystical experience or a beautiful experience so that we can say to ourselves, we have a mystical experience, we have a beautiful experience. You know, it's hard to be natural, you know, because we're always grasping at because of our fear. If you do some zazen, eventually you get up and you just hear the wind with this blank mind. And you become the wind. You become the wind. You become the world. In my opinion, this is the only hope, right? The world is uncontrollable, infinite. We're tiny little creatures like a cricket on the edge of a sink. How do we live? How do we deal with that? And the Zen idea is to cultivate, deepen your trust. And trust is not like believe something even though it's ridiculous. That's not our view. Nobody hands you a book and says, this is the truth. Believe it. Our method is to go deep into the mind, to the bottom of the mind, and notice that already there is this trusting mind, this unshakable, imperturbable calm, which feels connected to everything. This is our way. This is called Zen. And this makes it possible for us to live like that fisherman in the Hiroshige painting, on the edge of this storm-tossed sea, on this cliff that could crumble any moment. And you know, if you look at that painting, the fisherman looks like he's smiling. It's like he's flying a kite. You know? It's like, how could he be smiling? But that's what this practice is all about. A monk asked Yunmen, when not producing a single thought, is there any fault or not? This is such a beautiful question. Because he's basically saying, you know, when you're not thinking, aren't you kind of, maybe you could say, aren't you kind of evading your responsibilities? Aren't you kind of not being a good citizen? Aren't you not, you shouldn't be here at Sesshin. You should be doing something else. You could be making money. You could be writing another article. You could be, you know, doing something. You know. So there maybe is a fault in what we're doing, right? Maybe there's something wrong with this. You know. So now we're back into the world of right and wrong. We become insecure. Maybe I should be doing something else. So the question is asking you to stay in your, is tempting you, I should say, to stay in the mind that evaluates, that judges, that says yes or no, right or wrong. And that mind is a fearful mind, basically. So the monk says to Yunmen, let me see if I can ask you a question that will push you back into that fearful, questioning mind that's always trying to get out of its distrust, but never can. And Yunmen doesn't take the bait. Fault or no fault, it doesn't matter. He just says, Matsumaru, feel that vastness. Feel that vastness. Bathe yourself. Swim in that ocean. Swim in that ocean. That timeless, deathless, birthless ocean. The more you swim, the deeper you immerse yourself in that, the more everything around you becomes a part of your life, like your flesh and bones. Right? Dogen, Zenji said, to practice Zen is to study the self, to study the self. So when we sit on the cushion, we're learning a lot about ourselves, We see our fears, we see our dreams, we see our bullshit, we see many things. So to practice Zen is to study the self. But ultimately, sooner or later, we enter that blank mind. To practice Zen is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be one with all things. This is Zen. Most beautiful, succinct statement. To practice Zen is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be one with all things. So today, day one of Sesshin, may be studying self, right? We have lots of problems. We think about them on the cushion. We have lots of anxieties we can live through on the cushion. Takes a little time, a little stillness, a little patience. Gradually, forgetting the self becomes possible. Gradually, it will be possible to get off the cushion and walk outside and look at your mind, and your mind will be absolutely blank and dark. And that is the beginning of a different way of life. And, you hear the bird, and the bird is you. You see the cricket on the edge of the sink, and you feel like you're looking in the face of your own mother, your own child. This is not philosophy. That's just how it is. It's just that kinship with all things is as natural as breathing in that mind. So please... Let's be together on Mount Sumeru.